Hebrews 10:23 says, "Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful." Stay tuned to another edition of Confessing Our Hope, the podcast of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary, as we sit down with Pastor Andy Webb to discuss Samuel Miller and other matters related to Princeton Seminary. Good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of Confessing Our Hope, the podcast of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. This is a weekly podcast of the seminary, and lately we've been able to actually keep it as a weekly podcast. The nice thing about this podcast, this one particularly today, is that I am no longer having to worry about the stress and strain of the seminary semester. I have finished my last final, and I am able to now look forward to a summer of preparation, as it were, for the fall semester. But anyway, be that as it may, this podcast is a little more relaxing for me, particularly this broadcast, because I don't have that proverbial brick swinging over my head any longer. As usual, I'm your host, William Hill, and as I indicated, this is a weekly podcast of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. If you are interested in more information about the seminary, you can visit us at our website, gpts.edu. If you have any questions or comments about this podcast in particular, you can write me at confessinghope@gpts.edu, and I do the best I can to answer every email I receive. And so feel free to write comments, questions, criticisms, or inquiries, and I will get back to you just as soon as I am able. Today we had the pleasure of speaking with a pastor, a man who was at our theology conference that is held typically every March of the year. He came to speak on the subject of Samuel Miller. And this man is currently a pastor of Providence PCA in the great state of North Carolina. And he has his MDiv from Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. And the man I'm speaking with today is Pastor Andy Webb. So, Andy, it's great to have you on the program. And I look forward to discussing a little bit about what you talked about at the conference and getting to know maybe through this internet technology, this man who's been long gone now, but still speaks in a great way today to us.
I'm glad to be able to talk to you about him.
Thanks, Andy. Now, Samuel Miller, that may be a name that people recognize, but they may not know much about him. So can you tell us a little bit about who Samuel Miller was?
Sure. Actually, during the conference, one of the things that I asked the audience was how many of you are familiar with the name Samuel Miller. And first, I started out by asking how many people are familiar with Charles Hodge. And, you know, there was a sea of hands. But then I asked how many of you are familiar with Samuel Miller, and far fewer hands went up. So he isn't as well known as Charles Hodge by any stretch of the imagination. And yet, in his day, he was as influential as Charles Hodge, particularly in the first half of the 19th century. Miller was the second professor at Old Princeton after Archibald Alexander. He was the professor of ecclesiastical history and church government, and it was really his own choice that was the reason he wasn't the first professor. He had pushed very strongly for Archibald Alexander, who was considered to be a stronger preacher, if not a better, I suppose, a model of the kind of experimental piety that they really wanted to push at Old Princeton. So he was he's best known as the second professor there. But before then, he had had a great career as a churchman. He was the pastor of one of the pastors, I should say, of the collegiate Presbyterian churches in New York City, which at the time when he was there was probably one of the most influential churches in the entire United States. So a great pastor and a great scholar as well.
Now, your conference paper, and I say that's kind of a buzzword for us around the seminary world that, you know, when we say conference paper, what does that mean? Well, your lecture, the thing that you spoke on at the conference, what was it specifically about Samuel Miller? What actual attack or angle did you take about him and his life?
Well, they wanted me to talk about his pastoral theology. I chose to talk about his biography, first off, because I think this was a person who needs to be reintroduced, so to speak, on the American scene. But then to talk about his faithfulness in what mm-hmm. he was doing, his piety, and the ways in which learning and piety came together in him, and he influenced so many students in that way. There wasn't there was nothing cold and doctrinaire about Miller, but at the same time he was a man who was tremendously learned and emphasized constantly the need of a learned ministry. And there was also nothing, you know, crazy in the modern sense, you know, goofy in his piety. He was not a man who was all zeal and no knowledge. But at the same time, there was a burning love of Christ in his breast that nobody who came in contact with him didn't detect. So he was a man who brought together faith and piety, zeal and knowledge beautifully. And that's what I wanted to try to convey to the students. And if possible, to relate that to GPTS's goals and mission, you know, logic on fire being one of the things that I often see from GPTS in GPTS material. So that was what I was trying to bring together in my speech or talk or whatever it was.
Yeah, it's interesting. The pastoral aspect, certainly here at the seminary, that's one of the, you know, the pastoral slash preaching aspect is certainly one of the big emphases and distinctives of the school. What is it about Samuel Miller that got you interested in him in the first place?
That's a good question, actually. I first encountered Samuel Miller when I was a seminary student. I'd never heard of him before going to seminary, and I was taking a look at Presbyterianism. I was taking a course called Reformed Spirituality at the time. And I was researching the subject of holy days in the church calendar, where it came in. And I picked up Miller's book on Presbyterianism. And it has an incredibly long title, but it's basically his defense of Presbyterian distinctives. He wrote it at a time when Presbyterianism was under attack, mostly by Anglicans in the United States. And he wrote why he believed in that volume why Presbyterianism was the ancient and apostolic religion. And he was defending old school Presbyterianism and particularly their view of holy days. And there was just one section on holy days that I was so impressed by. It kind of finished all the other arguments for me and nailed it. And from that point onwards, I was thinking to myself, I must read this man. The long title that I was avoiding, incidentally, is Presbyterianism, the Truly Primitive and Apostolical Constitution of the Church of Jesus Christ, which is one of those typical mouthfuls that, you know.
Well, that sounds very much like a Puritan title.
Yeah, it does. Well, no, the Puritan title would have had three or four more paragraphs. You know,
sure. And
that would have been short by comparison.
Yeah, and a few subtitles under those
right.
as well. Now, you mentioned old school Presbyterianism, and for the sake of those listening to this, and I certainly know what you mean by that. You obviously know what you mean by that. But there may be a lot of people, they think, well, old school, does that mean there's a new school? What are we talking about when we talk about old school Presbyterianism?
Well, there certainly is an old and new school Presbyterianism. Old school Presbyterianism, and the way that that phrase came about was there was a schism in the Presbyterian church in the United States in the 1800s. With between the old school and the new school men. The new school men were less confessional. They were pushing for what Finney had called the new measures or revivalism instead of revival. We would all want revival, but these men had plans for revivalism. Also, you began to see things like Arminianism creeping into their belief structure. And just generally, there was what we might call today in our sphere a loose view of subscription. Really, was what marked the new school men. They were far more culturally influenced, whereas the old school men stuck to the old paths. Now, that's not to say that they weren't, you know, warm experimental Calvinists. They were. The old school men were very much in that frame of the frame of the Log College and the Gilbert and William Tennant school. And I realize I'm using names that probably are not going to be that familiar with your listeners, but these were men who believed strongly in preaching for revival, preaching for conversion, that our preaching should aim at the head and the heart, but at the same time, they believed in the Calvinistic doctrines taught in the confessions, and they wanted to hold on to them, whereas the New School men were more, as I said, more Arminian, more culturally influenced, and had this system of revivalism that they were pushing for.
And Samuel Miller, he was, you indicated that he laid out certain distinctives of Presbyterianism. Mm-hmm. What are some of those distinctives? And as you're thinking through that, and we're talking back and forth about that, it might even be interesting for the sake of our modern culture to compare some of that over against what where we find ourselves maybe today.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that is, yeah, that's a... that is an interesting topic. In terms of old school Presbyterianism, really the genius of old school Presbyterianism is the idea that everything that we do in our faith and our life and our practice as Presbyterians or as Christians should be based upon the Bible. So if it comes to the worship of the church, then the worship of the church is to come directly out of what the Bible teaches. We're not supposed mm-hmm. to make stuff up, and that is really, that's the heart of old school Presbyterianism. It means, for instance, that we stick to, in our worship, what's called the regulative principle of worship, which states that if it's not in the Bible, we don't do it. If it's not commanded in the Bible, then it shouldn't be part of our worship. So as a result, that differs greatly, as you probably know, from modern Presbyterian worship with its P&W and praise and worship and stuff like that. Modern Presbyterian worship, really the worship system has been influenced heavily by Episcopalianism, which states that the church has authority to come up with rites and ceremonies, and also from the modern seeker-sensitive movement, which basically states that if people like it, it should be part of our worship, as long as it's not specifically, opposed to the, as long as it's not outright idolatry or something like that, then we should be doing it.
And did Samuel Miller lay out in any kind of written form these distinctives, or are these just something that have been gleaned from his life and his writings and his lectures and preaching?
Well, it's hard to say. The it really is laid out in his book on Presbyterianism. I mean, he states specifically what Presbyterians believe and what they don't believe. For instance, and you got to understand that the main body that he was arguing against at that point in time was Anglicanism, or Episcopalianism, as we would call it, in the Episcopalian theories of worship and the priesthood, as opposed to the idea that the officers of the church should be elders and deacons. So he was really arguing against the Anglicans, who were attacking Presbyterianism and saying that it didn't have any right to exist, that they that Presbyterian pastors, for instance, were not successors of the apostles, and that Presbyterianism was an innovation and it should be dispensed with. And he was arguing, no, it's Presbyterian that's biblical. Episcopalianism is the innovation. It was the thing that came in later on. We're going back to the biblical roots of church government. So in Presbyterianism, that book that I was speaking of, he outlines what it is that that Presbyterians believe about worship, about church government, and although it's not a systematic theology, it is a wonderful kind of sprint through church history in the Bible and explaining why we believe what we believe.
Hmm.
So I'd recommend that one.
Yeah, we'll have to, at the end of this broadcast, we'll get the title from you so I can post that for those who might be interested in mm-hmm. Getting that, acquiring that, and looking through it. Now, your conference lecture was directed using the life of Samuel Miller, and the things and influences that he had were directed at the life specifically of the pastoral ministry or those training to be in the pastoral ministry. Now, how does his life and the things that he wrote do that? I mean, what specific things, and I guess I'm thinking back to the things you said maybe at the conference without redoing the entire lecture.
yeah.
But thinking back through some of the things that you said in that lecture, where in this venue, as we're talking, I'm able to interrupt you, as it were, or maybe ask probing questions that where nobody was able to do that back in March when you were talking, that you just talked and everybody listened, hopefully. And but here we can, I can maybe interact a little bit more with some of the things that you said, specifically related to the goal of using Samuel Miller as a springboard or a model or an example in the pastoral / preaching office.
Well, first off, his published works are still of immense value. Some of it's a little archaic. For instance, one of his works that was written specifically for students for pastoral students who were going into pastoral ministry was written on clerical habits or clerical manners, and it was basically a book designed to tell ministers how they should be deporting themselves, if I can use that archaic term, in the world, how they should be living in the world. And it's not it's valuable these days, if only because it's a question I don't think we think about. What kind of life should a minister live? What kind of seriousness should he conduct himself with? What kind of things should he speak about? Shouldn't he speak about? How should he be perceived by the world? And it wasn't a way, you know, I need to emphasize this. Miller was not by any stretch of the imagination saying that we should pretend or put on airs. Far from it. He was saying that somebody who loves the Bible, somebody whose blood is bibline, to use Spurgeon's phrase, this is the way that he'll look in front of the world. And so that's one of his valuable books. He talks about ways of communicating the gospel to others in your everyday conversation, things like that. So his letters on clerical manners, and there's just some good advice. He says he talks about theological students being overly addicted to tobacco. He says they're the worst for that, and he says, you know, it's never impressive to be completely inundated with the smell of smoke, or to be surrounded by a pool of tobacco spittle when you're, you know, attempting to press for the claims of Jesus Christ, things like that. But so clerical manners, his doctrinal works on Presbyterianism, the one that I just mentioned, for instance, his work on the ruling elder. I would recommend that anybody who wants to be a teaching elder in a church, in a Presbyterian church, needs to read his book on the ruling elder. It really will open up to them how these men who they're going to be laboring alongside should be working alongside them within the church, supporting them, and so on. It's a wonderful reference to give to your ruling elders to read. So that's a godsend. Also, his sermons and his essays are models to modern pastors on how to use church history in supporting your works. Or supporting your teaching. There's a tendency in Episcopalianism, I find, Roman Catholicism, to just draw from church history. But Miller does a wonderful thing. He starts with the Bible, and then he backs it up and says, and this is how it was worked out in the history of the church, either for good or for bad. And it's that historical mode of thinking that he's got that I don't think we have today. And the great value of that is it shows us where there were successes in the church and where we can expect there to be successes today, and where there were errors in the church, and we should expect the same errors to come up if we do the same thing. So that would be ways in which I think Miller is particularly valuable for students today.
When you talk about the things that he mentioned, and I'm kind of zeroing in on a couple of these categories that you mentioned, in one in particular, because I think it has practical relevance, not just for necessarily for ministers, but certainly for them. But this whole idea of the minister's life.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think there's a tendency to, I don't even know what the word is. There's a tendency to place the pastors in such a position that it's almost papist in a way. They're elevated in such a degree that they're not allowed to have a life. They're not a. I don't think that's what he's referring to. He's talking about. Is he talking about the more practical elements of conducting oneself even as a Christian? In other words, you're a Christian first, who happens to be a minister of the gospel, and that means that your Christianity needs to measure up to that calling that you have as a minister. And in what ways does he talk about that? I mean, what specific things does he suggest or even state directly as it pertains to that category?
Well, one of the things that he mentioned, and I first let me back up and say, no, he's not drawing this absolute sacred secular distinction that you you see in the Roman Catholic Church at all. He felt that every minister should be first and foremost, obviously, a man whose life was given over to God in each and every part of its of the way that he lived his life. But also, he felt that every minister should be a Christian gentleman. That his manners should be good, that his habits should be good, that he should be somebody who added to the luster of the gospel rather than detracted from it and added to its offense. It shouldn't be harder to believe the gospel because of the way that the minister was living. And one of the things that I got to tell you, William, I'm sorry, I did it, didn't I? I've got to tell you, Bill, that I really appreciated was this. We are living in an era of almost enforced informality. Everything has to be informal. You see these pastors who they must have spent hours in order to look grungy. I mean, literally, you know, they've got the gel in their hair making it spiked all up. You know, they're... their shirt is immaculately ruffled and pulled out of their shorts, and they're wearing, you know, Birkenstocks that I couldn't even afford, and things like that. And it's all this hey, I'm hip, I'm cool, I'm casual. There's no air of formality about me, and this is supposed to make them approachable and relevant and so on. To my mind, it destroys all of the distinction between the world and the church. It destroys the right formalism that should attend the preaching of the gospel. I mean, sometimes I think we forget that what we're doing when we are preaching the gospel is delivering the words of a king, and not just an earthly potentate, but the ruler of the entire universe. And we're acting as his ambassadors, all right? And you don't see ambassadors going, you know, to heads of state dressed in sloppily jeans and and T-shirts and, I come bearing word from Barack, your bud, and, you know. And there should be this sense because, I mean, what the king is proposing is a peace treaty via the completed work of his son to people who, outside of that that peace that he alone can give them, are rebels and enemies. We're talking about matters of life and death, and there should be a reverence, an awe, a fear that's involved in it. That's very difficult when you're. I mean, how many fearful messages can a guy wearing a Hawaiian shirt really deliver?
Why do you think, not to interrupt you, but why do you think, because I mean, you're right, and I agree with you. I think there is sort of this informalism, if that's even a word. There's it's almost very laid back, casualistic. Again, I probably just made up another word. mentality, even within the ranks of the ministerial office. Why do you think that is, though? Why is that a pervasive element in our, I guess, Western culture? I've never been to Europe, so I can't speak to that, but I have been in enough churches in the United States to know that, you know, in a lot of ways, that's what we're getting.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that, in your opinion, of course?
In the churches? I think there's a lot of reasons that have come together. One, it's that the pop culture is leading the church rather than the church supposedly being a model for the culture. We've lost our willingness to be countercultural. To be weird, to be peculiar. We just want to fit in with everybody. And so as society is becoming more more and more informal, but I think there's really a theological shift that's going on in two particular areas. First, the sovereignty of God is just gone. So the idea that that we should be in awe, that we should be, that he is our father and that we should treat him with respect is just not there any longer. There's this sense that God is our best bud. He's gone from, I've heard a lot of English preachers use this phrase, he's gone from being the almighty to the old matey. He's, you know, he's the guy you hang out with now in mom's basement and play Xbox and eat Cheetos with. It's not But that's not God. That's not the God of the Bible. That's not the rule of the universe. So I think the sovereignty of God and the idea that he is the grand potentate of the universe has begun to disappear from our preaching. Also, not just the sovereignty, but the long-term influence of Arminianism and open theism, even if it's not called that, have made it, I can call upon God to help me, but he's not the ruler of my life. This carnal Christianity is almost the norm these days. That's why you got, and that, of course, was related once again to his sovereignty, but this idea that God is not somebody who we're supposed to be in fear of. The preaching of the law is something that you don't see, because in order for there to be a law, there's got to be a king who's making the laws. And, so it's... all of the judicial aspects, all of the ruling aspects, I think, have gone out, and we've got kind of the fuzzy, warm grandfather God, or unfortunately grandmother God in some cases, who we should feel just, completely at ease with. And so it's a caricature, it's an idol. God has become, a deity of our own making, who is more like... the senile, beneficent grandmother than the awesome ruler that you see in the Psalms, and our view of Jesus, gentle Jesus, meek and mild. I think the smiling hippie has really superseded the actual Jesus of the Bible. Certainly, the Jesus of Revelation 19, the warrior king who's returning to fight the final battle. He doesn't work in the modern construct that the church has made.
How would you respond? And I'm gonna take the other side of the table for a second, just to, because I'm sure there's somebody out there who listens to this program and is thinking, yeah, okay, fine. You're getting all hung up on the way we dress, which I don't think that's the issue.
No.
And I think you just very clearly said that's not the issue. But let me pose this question, because I can already hear people thinking this in their mind. Well, Paul said we should be all things to all people. And that's all I'm doing, because I know that if I wear, if I dress in a certain way in a certain circumstance, that's not going to attract anybody.
Mm-hmm.
How would you respond to that?
Well, I think we've misunderstood Paul to a certain extent. For instance, Paul, in saying I need to be all things to all people, doesn't mean that, okay, I'm dealing with a drunkard, so I've got to become a drunkard in order to speak to him. I don't have to adopt, first off, anything that's sinful in order to speak to somebody. Neither do I have to adopt a cultural paradigm that runs directly against what Christianity is all about. For instance, we're dealing with the whole issue of homosexuality, and there's this pervasive idea that you can be a Christian, you can be a homosexual as well, or you've got to stop talking about sexual sins or any sort of sins in order to reach people. But Paul came into the Greek world, and he spoke things diametrically opposed to their belief structure. And he talked about, for instance, the resurrection of the body, which was something that had deeply offended them. Mm-hmm. He didn't become a believer that the flesh was bad in order to reach the Greeks. Sometimes he went right against their cultural model. And also, he never detracted from the reverence of God. Some of the most exalted words in the entire Bible about the person of the Messiah, Jesus Christ, you will find in the epistles of Paul. He goes into these reverential diatribes, and he speaks in a way where he humbles himself and he raises up Christ. So, yes, culturally, we need to be willing. If I go to Mongolia, I need to be willing to live in a yurt, to dress like a Mongolian, to eat what they eat, to speak the way they speak, and so on. And I do believe that there's something that we can learn from that, in that we don't have to make people, for instance, Americans, in order to teach them the gospel. And that really was kind of an idea that was pervasive. And up until the late 1950s, that you went into another culture, you Americanized them, or if you're a British ministry, you Anglicized them, and then you could teach them the gospel. But we can, teach Mongolians to be Christians in a Mongolian cultural complex, but at the same time, we don't grab their beliefs that they had before they were Christians and kind of put a thin Christian veneer over them and say that's okay. So I don't take the pop culture, Christianize it, and then say that's Christianity, okay? Lady Gaga is fundamentally opposed in her belief system, in the way that she conducts herself, to the Christian faith. And so we don't want to create Lady Gaga Christians. There was a kind of a roughness, a rudeness to American society in Samuel Miller's day. And Samuel Miller was saying that pastors shouldn't be rough, rude, idiosyncratic people who would offend the sensibilities of a cultured person in order to bring the gospel to them. Okay, so he was somebody who believed that that we, as I said before, should be striving to be Christian gentlemen, and that was mainly what he was hitting on. And I think he's right.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think you said that very well, especially given the context of even going into foreign fields, missions. You know, we're not saying, you know, in America, business professionals, for lack of a better category or title, they wear shirt, tie. You know, frankly, if I went to my doctor's office and the guy was dressed like a bum, I'd be a little afraid for him to, you know, touch me, thank you. And if I went to a lawyer who looked like he just rolled out of the, you know, rolled out of a bar, I'd be a little concerned with him handling any of my legal issues. It's a perception.
And Miller actually made that point in his Clerical Manners. He said, you know, you wouldn't go, he put it quite, using the same examples you did, you wouldn't go to a doctor or a lawyer who appeared to be an idiot. So you don't want to, you know, come across that way either.
Absolutely. But at the same time, you know, we don't go into a foreign country and say, look, in order to be a good Christian, you have to wear a shirt and tie. That's not the issue. But I think the issue is, as you stated it, that we don't adopt the culture and sort of merge it into a Christian or Christianize it or merge it into the Christian idea and then call it Christianity. There's a distinct difference between that. And I think that's really what Paul was getting at, as you've already indicated. We're running a little short on time, and I know we kind of ran a little afield there for a second, but let me ask this question. This is maybe more thought-provoking or might generate some thinking from other people, but if Samuel Miller were alive today, and based on your study and reading of him and the work that you did, especially to present this material at the conference, how might he react to what he sees going on in the church in general, but specifically in Presbyterianism as a whole?
Oh my, that's such a wide-ranging question.
It is. So
do I get in trouble if I say I think he'd be appalled?
absolutely not. If you didn't say that, I might be a little I would probably be somewhat disappointed.
Not that I'm glad that he'd be appalled. No, he we've gotten away from so much of what I think he and Hodge would have regarded to be the genius of Presbyterianism. We are way too influenced by the culture. We want to be loved by everyone. He was by no means a polemical man by nature. He had a very irenic character. But at the same time, he fought for Presbyterianism whenever it was under attack, and he was a great defender. I mean, he thought it was the teaching of the Bible. There's no reason you shouldn't stand for the distinctives. And he was also very, very zealous for Presbyterian worship. He obviously came from the era of exclusive psalmody, did not believe in instruments in worship and things like that. Now, we might argue with him over whether I happen to believe that the singing of hymns and spiritual songs is commanded in Scripture, so that it's part of the regulative principle. And I do believe that music, if it's not overpowering, obviously, and not solos, not special music and so on, but the playing of piano, guitar, a flute to accompany the singing of the congregation, especially in our non-musical age, that this is a circumstance that aids in the in congregational singing, which is the element of worship. But just generally, all of the introduction of all these elements that aren't part of the worship, things like skits, liturgical dance, and just generally the lack of reverence within our worship would have appalled him. Also, one of the things that you see in his sermons, he presses always, you know, the urgency of the gospel and our need to close with Christ, but it's always law and gospel. And very much He had a Christian worldview. He did not have a Christianized worldview. He believed that, for instance, America should be a nation that was... he believed that the goodness of America, for instance, came from the fact that it was a nation founded upon a Christian worldview. It's one of the reasons why... and it's very interesting. And I know I'm getting further afield here. He started off as a supporter of Thomas Jefferson because he was very much a believer in Jefferson's limited government and republicanism and so on. But when he realized that Jefferson was a deist, or to his thinking, an infidel, especially when Jefferson refused to approve of Day of Prayer, his thinking about Jefferson changed dramatically. So he was a man who believed very much that a Christian worldview should be driving our lives, our congregations, our nation. And I think if we've lost anything in Christianity, it is that Christian worldview. We've simply adopted the pop culture's worldview, baptized it, and we call it Christian. And I think he would be appalled at that. I think also he would be appalled at the lack of if there's one huge difference between Miller and his time and ours today, it's the lack of an educated ministry. His trials, I don't think most of our professors could have passed his ordination trials, the things that he was required to do.
We have 50 times more seminaries today than he had in his day. But we have less educated ministers.
Yes, and you see that in just a lack of Bible training. But if I can give you an example of what he had to go through in order to become a licentiate, and we're not talking about ordination. This is just his licensure trials. They took three separate presbytery meetings. They included an oral examination in Latin and Greek, experimental religion, general college studies, and theology. He also had to deliver two sermons, an exegetical paper on Luke, an exegetical paper delivered in Latin on the question of whether Christ descended into hell as well. And so, I mean, this is just for licensure. The expectation was that a man coming into the ministry at that age would have been an expert in the Bible and in the related theological doctrines around it, and also would have had a competent knowledge of what they would have called secular learning, that this man would really have been very, very bright. And he, the way Miller put it was in his inaugural, he delivered the inaugural address at Old Princeton when Archibald Alexander was being installed as the first professor. And he said that a student for the ministry should have four qualities. First was piety, without which you can't have a student for the ministry. It doesn't matter how smart he is. If he doesn't love the Lord and if he's not concerned to glorify him in his own life, then he's no student for ministry. Secondly, that he would have talents. Thirdly, that he would have competent knowledge. And fourthly, diligence. And I think that our ministerial candidates, generally speaking, and I say this with no great, no triumphalism at all. It saddens me that our ministerial candidates, as a general rule, are lacking in all four of those. We're not diligent. I mean, how many times do we hear of men who download their sermons from the internet? I sometimes wonder, what is a church paying a man for if he's downloading a sermon? Why not employ an actor? He would do a better job of delivering it.
That's right. That's right.
He could do Rick Warren impersonations for you. But so I think that would have been the thing that probably would have appalled him the most, that the ministry has sunk so low, not only in practice but in our estimation. It's just not what it used to be. And that's probably one of the reasons why the doctrinal knowledge within the pews is so much lower as well.
Yeah, well, that stands to reason. If your ministers are not equipped from the educational perspective at the very least, there's no possible way for them to communicate that which they don't own.
Mm-hmm.
And how would you, if you had the ability in and of yourself to rectify some of these problems that certainly are there. I've been in presbytery meetings and I have seen examinations on the floor that, I don't know what the word is. They just seem so surface Yeah, that's a great word. They're disappointing. I think, wow, I could have answered those questions, and I didn't even go to seminary. Yeah. How do we fix it in our culture that seems in very much in a hurry to get stuff done? And because of that, it seems things get short-circuited or corners get cut. How do we fix that today?
Well, one thing that we have to do is we have to abandon the pragmatic. Now, one of the things that I want to emphasize is this was a problem in Miller's day, and he was arguing strongly against it. And the Princeton faculty were very much with him. But one of the New School emphases was that they did believe that there was too much emphasis on knowledge and learning and doctrine and so on. And in that, they were heavily influenced by the Methodists and the Baptists. Methodist churches were spreading like wildfire. I mean, all you really needed to be a Methodist circuit riding minister was a fairly good knowledge of the Bible, a Bible, and a horse, and you could be a Methodist minister. And that's one of the reasons why it was much, much easier to set up a Methodist church than it was a Presbyterian one. Also, the Methodists didn't need a Presbyterian and so on. So from a pragmatic standpoint, the Methodist way of training ministers and establishing churches was better. But the long-term results of it were, dramatically worse. And any time that you had that lack of doctrinal knowledge, inevitably heresy filled the vacuum. That's what happened on the frontiers, within Presbyterian circles, where you had less doctrine, less oversight, less accountability. You began to get heresies cropping up, and the same thing happens today with bad theology will inevitably fill the vacuum if there is no good theology being taught. What we have to do is to look in church history, and we need to say that the pragmatic approach to things, what's easiest, never produces good fruit over the long run, and that it's actually the hard road, the taking up our cross and following after Christ and walking the hard road, the road of sorrows, the Via Dolorosa sometimes, is going to be the better way of training. So rather than trying to cut corners, and I've been at GA when they've been coming up with all these plans to make, ministerial education even easier, rather than cutting corners, we should be asking, why aren't our students, I heard Brian Chappell, for instance, the head of, or until recently, the president of CTS, saying that it used to be that two-thirds of our students passed the English Bible exam coming in, now two-thirds failed the English Bible exam coming in.
I read that report.
So it's, we should be asking ourselves, why does this happen? How do we stop it? Rather than how do we make it even easier to become a minister when we know that the results of that approach are not good historically and in fact. So I think we need to abandon that ungodly pragmatism that says, let's just take the easy road whenever we can.
Yeah, and just for the record, since this is a podcast of Greenville Seminary, I just received an email today from one of our professors actually reminding the student body that in order to graduate from this seminary, you have to pass a rather extensive Bible knowledge exam. You can't just walk out of here with a diploma because you fulfilled, Greek and Hebrew. Okay, so you're equipped. No, that's important. Don't get me wrong. But we have here at this seminary, you have to pass an extensive written Bible exam.
And if I can just not specifically to Puff GPTS, but I like their approach. I really do. I think that their emphasis on is the old Princeton emphasis, that it does keep those four critical attributes in mind, and that what we need are more institutions that meld that desire that GPTS had, that old Princeton had. Their values, their goals, with professors like Samuel Miller. But the problem is there's so few of those men around, unfortunately.
Well, and as some may know, and most probably don't, that is actually the model that this seminary was founded on, the old Princeton approach to doing things. And by the Lord's goodness, and he has enabled the board here to maintain that. with strong leadership and sound educational instruction in the classroom. But it goes way beyond that. And so it's an important distinctive, and I think it's a necessary one. And as you indicated, in our culture today, we don't need less educated men standing in the pulpit.
Yeah.
They didn't need less educated men standing in the pulpit in Miller's day. We definitely don't need it in today's world, especially with the internet and all the social networking capabilities and options out there. We need men who are able to deal with these things in a 21st century context, but be academically equipped to do that, as well as, of course, having the moral fiber that is often ignored. He has the degree, so he must be a minister kind of mentality. And, well, be that as it may, maybe that's true, maybe it's not, but I've always tended to have a higher regard. I think someone once said that if you love your people and you model Christ to your people, they'll forgive bad preaching. But if you don't do those things, they won't forgive you your bad preaching at all. So it's a both and proposition, certainly. Andy, just real quick before we close, what resources might you offer someone who's listening to this and thinks, you know, I'd like to read some more of this old school Presbyterian guy, Samuel Miller, and things that he said, because that's interesting to me, and I'd like to know more about that.
All right. In terms of just getting an introduction to who was this guy, Samuel Miller, I think it's David Calhoun's works on Princeton. He gives a wonderful retrospect of his life and his work and his piety, especially his labors at Princeton. And that was, I believe, the first biography I ever read of Samuel Miller. Also, they were reprinted by Solid Ground a while back. The Annals of the American Presbyterian Pulpit, Volume 1 by William Sprague, has a wonderful little biography of Samuel Miller, as well as a bunch of the other eminent churchmen of the 19th century, which should give you a toehold. In terms of reading other biographical works, there one of his descendants, also named Samuel Miller, wrote a two-volume biography of Samuel Miller. I would not recommend necessarily reading that particular book, simply because it's not exact. It could have been edited down to one volume. Let's put it that way. And it's just got too many quotations. I mean, it's a wonderful historical resource, but it makes for very, very heavy reading. In terms of stuff he wrote himself, I've already talked up his book on Presbyterianism. The Ruling Elder is something that absolutely every teaching elder, and certainly every ruling elder as well, should have read. Those were the ones that I would definitely start on. His also his clerical manners, still, like I said, very good for people who are going or planning on studying the ministry. There's some stuff that'll make you smile. I love his comment, for instance. I'm sorry to make this comment. He believed that you shouldn't Presbyterian ministers shouldn't have a drinking problem, and he included water in that. He believed that we drink far too much water and that we should be carrying it into the pulpit. So he said he was disgusted by ministers who couldn't finish a sermon without taking several sips of water every few minutes.
Well, even we can agree with even some of the giants of the faith on some things.
I would be condemned by that as well. I apparently have a water drinking problem. Anyway, infant baptism, scriptural and reasonable, and baptism by sprinkling or effusion, the most suitable and edifying mode. It sounds like a mouthful. It's actually based on two sermons, but believe it or not, this is the best comprehensive explanation of the Presbyterian views of infant baptism that I've ever read. Especially the appendices to it are also really, really valuable in explaining why we do things and we don't do things, what we think that the sacrament of baptism does and doesn't do, who it should be administered to, who it shouldn't be. It's a wonderful old-school kind of synopsis of our view of infant baptism, and I always recommend it to people who are struggling with different views of infant baptism. I think it would be wonderful also if, and I hate to get polemical, it's a wonderful corrective to the views of the federal vision regarding baptism, and showing that Presbyterians did not believe what the federal vision guys are saying that they believed about baptism. This is interesting. If you're ever dealing with the issue of slavery, he wrote a sermon that was delivered in 1797, a discourse delivered before the New York City for the Manumission of Slaves. You can still get the bound photocopy of it, and it is it's fascinating. He really did see the Civil War coming over this issue, so it's well worth reading. Especially, you know, because we have to deal with attacks on the Bible on that particular issue, and be able to answer, being able to produce a churchman who wrote a great, reasoned defense on why slavery was not something that Christians should be engaged in, at least not the way it was practiced in the Old South, is very helpful. So that would be one of the things I would recommend. There's a lot of different stuff he wrote. If you're ever looking for a wonderful synopsis of the origins of American Presbyterianism in its formative years in the late 18th century around the Revolutionary War as well. His biography of his good friend, the Reverend John Rogers, is just tremendous. It really is worth reading. It's a shame he wrote a better biography of his fellow worker John Rogers than the later Samuel Miller wrote of him. So,
really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, those are some great resources, yeah. And I will try to make those all available on the GPTS website where we house all of these podcasts. I am currently working, in fact, on a different site to try to streamline some of the media outreaches that we have here and sort of put them all together instead of having them segregated as we've currently got them over different platforms, but we're trying to move them all into one area where it makes it just simple for everybody to just go to one place, get what they want, and not have to hunt all over the place to find it. So we're working on that. It's still a little ways away from coming. I'm also working on the possibility, of having a mobile app for the seminary that will allow this podcast to be placed there so resources and that kind of thing could be simply clicked on, but your smartphone, hey, look, we live in the 21st century and might as well use this technology as long as we can do it at a reasonable cost. So these are things we're working on, and I will try to get these resources up on the website for those who listen use. I try to include links to the resources so that you can go right to them, and if I happen to find free copies of that kind of thing in PDF format or whatever, and they are out there if you look for them. I'll try to include those as well. Andy, it's been great. We've had, I know we've talked kind of around some subjects, and you've introduced a few subjects we could probably do a whole hour on in and of itself. But I think it would be good for people to plunge back into some of these men of old, as it were, and reflect. Here's where we are, and here's what they were talking about even back then. And, you know, here's where we are now as a church. And had we done more to listen to those men back then, it would have been much better for us now. So, but I do appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and with this podcast here at Greenville Seminary, and appreciate your labors and your work, and of course your conference lecture. Is that going to be included in the written format? Do you know?
If I ever put together the footnotes and get it, that's the idea.
Because I, as I understand things, that is going to be released in a written
format. The Confessional Presbyterian is where it's supposed to be coming out. And I'm a little behind on getting that in, so thank you for pricking my conscience on.
Well, yeah, and I think the seminary actually is going to release a series of those as well in a book format. I may be wrong on that. Don't quote me on it, but I think that's the plan anyway, last I had heard. And, of course, I will announce that information to everybody when it does happen, and people would want to get their hands on some of those lectures as well and be able to do it in a written format so you can sit and ponder over it and read through it and digest it there. So anyway, Andy, it's been great. I appreciate your time, and trust the Lord will bless your work and ministry there in Fayetteville and that you'll see fruit from it, and stay the course, of course, Stay the course, of course. It's a good thing my rhetoric professor doesn't listen to these. He would crucify me for my terrible grammar I tend to have sometimes. Yeah, but anyway, appreciate your time.
No, it's been my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Bill. Good talking to you.
Thank you.
Okay.
You've been listening to a discussion with Andy Webb. He's a pastor at PCA Church out in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And he's been talking with me about his conference lecture he did a few months back on Samuel Miller. And we talked a little bit about some of the issues, but we also talked about the particulars of his lecture as well. And I would strongly encourage people to think about and look back on and read some of these older men in our church history. There's a lot to glean and a lot to benefit from. And I think if we just take the time to do these things, take a Lord's Day afternoon and start working through some of these pieces of material, I think it would benefit you as a Christian in your walk with Christ. And certainly that's what we're trying to convey. Ultimately, that's what we're hoping people do, that they're edified in their faith and in their walk with the Lord, not just to fill their minds with more information about church history, but to use it, you know, as a means to grow and be strengthened in this most precious doctrine that we have, that is the Reformed faith. And so I would encourage you to take advantage of those opportunities and those resources that have been presented. Think through them. I am not really sure what my schedule is for the next couple of weeks as far as who's coming on and when. I have an idea, but I don't want to tip my hand too soon. I will be away next week, so there will not be a podcast next week. I will be at the Banner of Truth Conference, so a little plug for them. That's happening up in Pennsylvania. It's a yearly conference. It's fantastic from what I hear. I've never been. I'm looking forward to it, though, this time. And so I will be away. The following week, I think I know who's coming on, but I don't want to necessarily say yet, but I will post that information on Twitter, Facebook, or wherever. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can follow Greenville Seminary at GPT Seminary. That's our Twitter name, just basically who we are, GPT Seminary. So you can follow us there. You can also follow me on Twitter. Look me up. I'm easy to find. So look me up. I'm there somewhere. Also, we're on Facebook, so you can find the seminary on Facebook as well. So until, I'm not really sure, I think it's 2 weeks, and with who, I'm not telling. We do hope you've enjoyed this particular edition of Confessing Our Hope, the podcast of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. And God bless.